On de musique. Note. Song On de musique, to music, set by Schubert in 1817 to a poem by his friend Franz von Schober, 1796 to 1882. End note.
A person asking to see you, sir. Mr. Gaye.
Otto Egori nodded. This being his only free afternoon in Foranoi, it was inevitable that some young hopeful would find him out and waste it. He knew from the way his man said person that it was no one important. Still, he had been buried so long in managing his wife's concert tour that it was refreshing to receive a postulant of his own.
"Show him in,"
he said, turning again to the letter he was writing, and did not look up till the visitor was well into the room and had had time to be impressed by the large, bald head of Otto Egorin, engrossed in writing a letter. That first impression, Otto knew, would keep all but the brashest ones down. This one did not look brash. A short, shabby man, leading a small boy by the hand, and stammering about the great liberty, valuable time, great privilege.
"Well, well," said the impresario,
moderately genial, since, if not put at ease, the timid often wasted more time than the brash.
"Playing chords since he could sit up, and the appassionata since he was three."
Note. Beethoven's Piano Sonata No. 23 in F minor, Opus 57, 1804-5, known as the appassionata, Italian, passionate. End note.
"Or do you write your own sonatas, eh, my man?"
The child stared at him with cold, dark eyes. The man stammered and halted.
"I'm very sorry, Mr. Egorin. I wouldn't have... My wife's not well. I take the boy out Sunday afternoon so she doesn't have to look after him."
It was really painful to see him going red, then pale, then red.
"He'll be no trouble," he blundered on. "What is it about, then, Mr. Gaye?"
asked Otto rather dryly.
"I write music," Gaye said, and Otto saw then what he had missed in supposing the child to be yet another prodigy,
the small roll of music paper under the visitor's arm.
"All right, good. Let me see it, please," he said, putting out his hand.
This was the point he dreaded with the shy ones. But Gaye did not explain for 20 minutes what he had tried to do and why and how, all the time clutching his compositions and sweating. He gave the roll of music to Egorin without a word, and, at Egorin's gesture, sat down on the stiff hotel sofa, the little boy beside him, both of them nervous, submissive, with their strange, steady, dark eyes.
"You see, Mr. Gaye, this is all that matters after all, eh? This music you bring me, you bring it to me to look at. I want to look at it. So please, excuse me while I do so."
It was his usual speech after he had pried the manuscript away from a shy, talkative one. This one merely nodded.
"It's four songs and part of a mass," he said in his barely audible voice.
Otto frowned. He had been saying lately that he had had no idea how many idiots wrote songs until he married a singer. The first he glanced at relieved his suspicions, being a duet for tenor and baritone, and he remembered to smooth the frown off his forehead. The last of the four caught his attention, a setting of a Goethe lyric. Note. Many poems by Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, 1749 to 1832, have been set as Lieder or songs by composers ranging from Mozart, 1756 to 1791, to Charles Ives, 1874 to 1954. The story does not specify which lyric Gaye has set to music, although in the original version of this story published in Western Humanities Review in 1961, the poem was identified as Über allen Gipfeln, 1780. End note. He moved very slightly as he sat at the desk, a mere twitch towards the piano, instantly repressed. No use raising hopes. To play a note of their stuff was to convince them at once that they were Beethoven and would be produced in the capital by Otto Egorin within the month. But it was a real bit of writing, that tune with the clever, yearning, quiet little accompaniment. He went on to the Mass, or rather, three fragments of a Mass, a Kyrie, Benedictus, and Sanctus. Note: a traditional musical Mass consists of five parts, Kyrie, Gloria, Credo, Sanctus and Benedictus, and Agnus Dei. The Kyrie is the opening sung prayer, and the Benedictus is part of the Sanctus, a short doxology. End note. The writing was neat, rapid, and crowded. Music paper is not cheap, thought Otto, glancing at his visitor's shoes. At the same time, he was hearing a solo tenor voice over a queer racket from organ, trombones, and double basses. Benedictus qui venit in nomine Domini. Very queer stuff. Note. Latin. Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. A line from the Roman Rite, the most widespread liturgical rite in the Catholic Church. End note. But no. There now, just when it's about to drive you mad, it all turns to crystal. So simply you'd swear it was crystal all along. And the tenor, the poor devil singing double piano, way up there. Find me the tenor who can do that, and fight off the trombones too. The Sanctus. Now splendid, the trumpet, really splendid. Otto looked up. He had been tapping the side of his hand on the desk, nodding, grinning, muttering. That had blown it. Come here, he said angrily. What's your name? What's this?
Ladislas Gaia, that's the second trumpet.
Why isn't it marked? Here, take it, play it. They went through the Sanctus five times. Plan, 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 Otto blared, a trumpet. All right. Why do your basses come in there? One, two, three, four, boom! In come the basses like elephants. Where does that get you?
Back to the Sanctus. Listen, here's the organ under the tenors.
And the piano roared under Gaia's husky tenor.
Sabaoth! Then the cellos and the elephants. Four. Sanctus! Sanctus! Sanctus!
He sat back from the piano. Otto took his eyes from the score. The room was silent. Otto set straight a drooping red rose in the bouquet on the top of the hired piano.
And where do you expect to have this Mass sung?
The composer was silent.
Women's chorus, double men's chorus, full orchestra, brass choir, organ. Well, well, let me see those songs again. Is this all you've written of the Mass?
The Credo isn't orchestrated yet.
Note. The movement of the Mass, named for its first word, Credo, I believe. End note.
I suppose you'll throw in double timpani for that? All right, here. Where is it? The Goethe. Let me play.
He played through the song twice, then sat twiddling out one of the queer half-spoken phrases of the accompaniment.
It's first rate, you know, he said. Absolutely first rate. What the devil? Are you a pianist? What are you?
A clerk.
A clerk? What kind of clerk? This is your hobby, eh? Your amusement in spare time?
No, this is what I...
Otto looked up at the man, short and shabby, white with excitement, inarticulate.
I want to know something about you, Gaia. You barge in, I write music. You show me a little music. Very good. Very good, this song, the Sanctus, the Benedictus, too. That's real work. I want to read it again. But I've been shown good writing before. Have you been performed? How old are you?
30.
What else have you written?
Nothing else of any size.
At 30? Four songs and half a Mass?
I haven't much time to work.
This is nonsense. Nonsense! You don't write this kind of thing without practice. Where did you study?
Here, at the Schola Cantorum, till I was 19.
With whom? Berdike? Che?
Che and Madame Vesserin.
Never heard of her. And this is all you'll show me?
The rest isn't good or isn't finished.
How old were you when you wrote this song?
Gaia hesitated.
20, I think.
10 years ago? What have you been doing since? You want to write music, eh? Well, write it. What else can I say? This is good, absolutely good, and so is that racket with the trombones. You can write music. But, my dear man, what can I do about it? Can I produce 4 songs and half a mass by an unknown student of Vaslas Che? No. You want encouragement, I know. Well, that I give. I encourage you. I encourage you to write more music. Why don't you?
I realize this is very little, Gaia brought out stiffly. His face was contorted. One hand was fiddling and pulling at the knot of his tie. Otto was sorry for him and unnerved by him.
Very little. Why not make it more? He said, genial.
Gaia looked down at the piano keys, put his hand on them. He was shaking.
You see, he began, then turned away with a jerk, stooping, hiding his face with his hands, and broke into sobs.
Otto sat like a stone on the piano bench. The small boy, forgotten all this time, sitting with his gray-stockinged legs hanging over the edge of the sofa, slipped down and ran to his father. Of course, he was blubbering too, but he kept pulling at his father's coat, trying to get at his hand, whispering,
"Papa, don't! Papa, please don't!"
Gaia knelt and put his arm around the child.
"Sorry, Vasily. Don't worry, it's all right."
But he was not yet in control of himself. Otto rose with some majesty and called in his wife's maid.
"Take the laddie. Go give him candy. Make him happy, eh?"
The girl, a calm Swiss who knew all Central Europeans were mad, nodded, ignoring the weeping man, and said,
"Come, what's your name?"
The child held on to his father.
"Go with her, Vasily," Gaia said.
The child let her take his hand and went out with her.
"You have a fine little boy," said Otto. "Now, sit down, Gaia. Brandy? A little, eh?"
He opened and shut desk drawers, puffed and grunted to himself, put a glass in Gaia's hand, sat down again at the desk.
"I can't,"
Gaia began, worn out, at rock bottom.
"No, you can't. Neither can I. These things happen. You were more surprised than I, perhaps. But listen now, Ladislas Gaia. I have no time for the woes of all the world. I have a great many cares of my own, and I'm very busy. But since we've come so far, I'd like to know what makes you break down like this."
Gaia shook his head. With the submissiveness that had vanished only while they were going through his score, he answered Otto's questions. He had had to quit the music school when his father died. He now supported his mother, his wife, his 3 children, on his pay as clerk for a plant that made ball bearings and other small steel parts. He had worked there 11 years. 4 evenings a week he gave piano lessons, for which they let him use a practice room at the Schola Cantorum. Otto did not find much to say for a while.
"The good Lord has seen fit to give you bad luck," he remarked.
Gaia did not reply. Indeed, good or bad luck seemed hardly adequate to describe this kind of solid, persevering mismanagement of the world, from which Ladislas Gaia and most other men suffered, and Otto Egorin, for no clear reason, did not.
"Why did you come to see me, Gaia?"
"I had to. I knew what you'd have to say, that I haven't written enough. But when I heard you were to be here, I swore to myself I'd see you. I had to. They know me at the Schola, but they're busy with their students, of course. Since Che died, there's no one who... I had to see you, not for encouragement, but to see a man who lives for music, who arranges half the concerts in the country, who stands for...
For success," said Otto Egorin. "Yes, I know. I wanted to be a composer. When I was 20 in Vienna, I used to go look at the house where Mozart lived. I used to go stare at Beethoven's tomb in the cemetery. I called on Mahler, on Richard Strauss, every composer who came to Vienna."
Note: German Romantic composers Gustav Mahler, 1860 to 1911, and Richard Strauss, 1864 to 1949. End note.
I soaked myself in their success, the dead and the living. They had written music, and it was played. Even then, you see, I knew I was not a real composer, and I needed their reality to make life mean anything at all. That's not your problem. You need only to be reminded that there is music, eh? That not everyone makes steel ball bearings?
Gaia nodded.
Is there no one else? Otto asked abruptly. To take care of Mama?
My sister married a Czech fellow. They live in Prague. And she's bedridden, my mother.
Yes. And there would still be the wife with the nervous disorder and the kids, eh, and the bills and the steel ball bearings plant. Well, Gaia, I don't know. You know, there was Schubert. I often wonder about Schubert. It's not just you that makes me think of him. Why did God create Franz Schubert? To expiate some other men's sins? Also, why did he kill the man off the moment he reached the level of the last quintet?
Note. Austrian composer Franz Schubert, 1797 to 1828, died 2 months after completing his string quintet in C major, regarded as one of the greatest chamber music compositions. End note.
But Schubert didn't wonder why God had created him. To write music, of course. Du holde Kunst, ich danke dir.
Note. German. You, lovely art, I thank you. The final line of the title song thanks the art of music, or art in general, which, the poet says, has transported me into a better world. End note.
Incredible! The little sickly, ugly crackpot with glasses, scribbling his music like any other crackpot, never hearing it played. Du holde Kunst. How would you say it? Thou gracious art, thou kindly art. As if any art were kindly, gracious, gentle. Have you ever thought of throwing it over, Gaia? Not the music, the rest.
He met the gaze of the strange, cold, dark eyes, and refused to be ashamed, to apologize. Gaia had said that he, Otto Egorin, lived for music. He did. He might be a good bourgeois, he might be very sorry for a poor devil who needed nothing in God's world but a little cash in order to be a good composer, but he would not apologize to the poor devil's sick mother and sick wife and three brats. If you live for music, you live for music.
I'm not made so.
Then you're not made to write music.
You thought differently when you were reading my Sanctus.
Du lieber Herrgott, Otto exploded.
Note. German. Dear God. End note. He was a great patriot, but his mother and his upbringing had been Viennese, and in moments of real emotion he reverted to German.
All right. Did it ever occur to you, my dear young man, that you incur a certain responsibility in writing something like that Sanctus? That you become answerable? That music has no arthritis, no nervous disorders, no hungry potbelly and, Papa, Papa, I want this, I want that. But all the same, she depends on you alone. Other men can feed brats and keep sick women, but no other man can write your music.
Yes, I know that.
But you're not quite sure anyone would undertake to feed the brats and keep the women. Probably they wouldn't. Doch, doch. You're too gentle, Gaia.
Note. Doch, doch. German. Yes, yes. End note. Otto strode up and down the room on his bandy legs, snorting and grimacing.
When I finish the Mass, may I send it to you?
Yes, yes, of course. I shall be pleased to see it. When will it be? 10 years from now? Gaia, who the devil's Gaia? Where did I meet him? This is good, a young fellow, he shows promise. And you'll be 40, getting tired, ready for a little arthritis or nervous disorder yourself. Certainly send me your Mass. You have great talent, Gaia. You have great courage, but you're too gentle. You must not try to write a big work like this Mass. You can't serve two masters. Write songs, short pieces, something you can think of while you work at this godforsaken steel plant, and write down at night when the rest of the family's out of the way for 5 minutes. Write them on anything, unpaid bills, whatever, and send them to me. Don't think you have to pay 2.5 kroner a sheet for this fine paper. You can't afford fine paper. When they're printed, is time to think of that. Send me songs, not 10 years from now, but a month from now. And if they're as good as this Goethe song, I'll give you a section on my wife's program in Krasnoy in December. Write little songs, not impossible masses. Hugo Wolf, you know. Hugo Wolf wrote only songs, eh?
Note. Hugo Philipp Jakob Wolf, 1860-1903, Austrian composer, primarily of Lieder. End note. He thought that Gaia, overcome with gratitude, was going to break down again, and though apprehensive, he felt pleased with himself, wise, generous. He had made the poor fellow happy and might get something from him, too. The accompaniment to the Goethe song was still running in his head, spare, dry, sorrowful, beautiful. Then Gaia began to speak, and Otto realized, slowly but without real surprise, that it was not gratitude at all.
The mass is what I've got to write, what I have in me. The songs come, sometimes a lot of them together, but I've never been able to write them at will. It has to be a good day. But the mass and the symphony I've been working on, they have size and weight. You see, they carry themselves along over the weeks, and I can always work on them when I have time. I know the mass is ambitious, but I know all I want to say in it. It will be good. I've learned how to do what I must do, you see. I've begun it. I have to finish it.
Otto had stopped in his pacing back and forth and was watching him with an expression both of incredulity and long-suffering familiarity.
Bah, he said, what the devil do you come to me for? And burst into tears? And then tell me thanks very much for your suggestion, but I shall continue to attempt the impossible. The arrogance, the unreasonableness. No, I can endure all that, but the stupidity, the absolute stupidity of artists, I cannot stand it any longer.
Abashed, submissive, Gaia sat there in his shabby suit. Everything about him was shabby, pinched, overstrained and underfed, ground down and worn thin. And Otto knew he could shout at him for 2 hours and promise him introductions, publication, performances. He would never be heard. Gaia would only say in his inaudible stammer,
I have to write the mass first.
You read German, eh?
Yes.
All right. After the mass is finished, then write songs. In German. Or French, if you like it. People are used to it. They won't listen in Vienna or Paris to a lot of songs in a language like ours, or Romanian, or Danish, or what have you. It's a mere curiosity, like folk songs. We want your music heard, so write for the big countries. And remember, most singers are idiots. All right?
You're very kind, Mr. Egorin,
Gaia said, not submissively this time, but with a curious formal dignity. He knew that Otto was yielding to his stubborn unreason, as he would to that of a great, a famous artist, humoring him, getting round him, when in fact he could as well have stepped on him like a beetle. He knew, in fact, that Otto was defeated.
If you'll put the elephants aside for a very little while, for a few evenings, in order to write something which might conceivably be published, be heard, you see,
Otto was saying, still ironic, exasperated, and deferent, when the door swung open and his wife made an entrance. She swept Gaia's little son in with her. The Swiss maid followed. The room all at once was full of men, women, children, voices, perfume, jewelry.
Otto, look what I found with Anna Elise. Did you ever see such an enchanter? Look at the eyes, the great, dark, solemn eyes. His name is Vasily. He likes chocolates. Such an enchanter, such a little man. Did you ever see such a child? How do you do? So glad. You're Vasily's. Yes, of course you are, the eyes. Oh, Christ, what a ghastly hole this town is. I want to leave on the first train after the concert, Otto. I don't care if it's 3 in the morning. I can feel myself beginning to look like all those huge empty stone houses across the river. All eyes, staring, staring, staring like skulls. Why don't they tear them down if nobody lives in them? Never again, never again, to hell with the provinces and encouraging national art. I can't sing in every graveyard in the country, Otto. Anna Elisa, draw my bath, please. I'm simply filthy. I must be gray as buckwheat. Are you the management from Sorg?
I've already talked to them on the telephone, said Otto, knowing that Gaia would be unable to answer. Mr. Gaia is a composer. He writes masses. He did not say songs, for that would catch Egorina's attention. He was paying Gaia back a little, giving him an object lesson in practicality. Egorina, uninterested in masses, talked on. An unceasing flood of words poured from her for 24 hours before each concert, and stopped only when she walked out on the stage, tall, magnificent, smiling, to sing. After she had sung, she would be quiet, ruminating. She was, Otto said, the most beautiful musical instrument in the world. He had married her because it was the only way to keep her from going on the light opera stage. Stubborn, stupid, and sensitive in proportion to her talent, she dreaded failure and wanted to succeed the sure way. So Otto had married her and made her succeed the hard way as a lieder singer. Note: lieder, or art songs, often a musical setting of a poem or text for one voice with piano accompaniment. End note. In October, she would take her first opera role, Strauss's Arabella. Note: a comic opera with a libretto by Austrian writer Hugo von Hofmannsthal, 1874 to 1929, which premiered in Dresden in 1933. End note. That probably meant she would talk for 6 straight weeks beforehand. Otto could bear it. She was very beautiful and generally good-humored, and anyway, one need not listen. She did not care whether one listened, so long as one was there, an audience. She talked on. The sound of rushing water came from the bathroom. The telephone rang. She began to talk on the telephone. Gaia had not said a word. The child stood beside him, grave as ever. Egorina had forgotten all about Vasily after making her entrance with him, and had been swearing like a sergeant. Gaia stood up. Relieved, Otto took him to the door, gave him 2 passes to Egorina's recital tomorrow night, shrugged off his thanks. "We're not sold out, you know. This is a dead town for music." Behind them, Egorina's voice flooded magnificently on. Her laugh broke out like the jet of a great fountain.
"Jesus, what do I care what that little Jew says?" she sang out, and again the great golden laugh.
"Gaia," said Otto Egorin, "you know there's one other thing. This is not a good world for music, either. This world now, in 1938. You're not the only man who wonders, what's the good? Who needs music? Who wants it? Who indeed, when Europe is crawling with armies like a corpse with maggots, when Russia uses symphonies to glorify the latest boiler factory in the Urals, when the function of music has been all summed up in Putzi playing the piano to soothe the leader's nerves?"
Note: Ernst Franz Sedgwick Hanfstengel, 1887 to 1975, nicknamed Putzi, or Little Fellow, a businessman of German and American parentage, met Adolf Hitler in 1922. He became part of Hitler's inner circle and was often called upon to play the piano. Hanfstengel was appointed foreign press chief of the Nazi Party in 1932, but gradually became estranged from Hitler. Fearing for his life, he went into exile in England in 1937. During World War II, he wrote confidential reports on Hitler and the Nazi leadership for the U.S. government. End note.
"By the time your mass is finished, you know, All the churches may be blown into little pieces, and your men's chorus will be wearing uniforms, and also being blown into little pieces. If not, send it to me, I shall be interested. But I'm not hopeful. I am on the losing side, with you. So is she, my Egorina there, believe it or not. She will never believe it. But music is no good, no use, Gaia. Not any more. Write your songs, write your mass, it does no harm. I shall go on arranging concerts, it does no harm. But it won't save us.
Ladislas Gaia and his son walked from the hotel to the old bridge over the Ross. Their home was in the old city, the bleak, jumbled quarter on the north side of the river. What Foranoi had in the way of wealth and modernity lay south of the river in the new city. It was a warm, bright day, late spring. They stopped on the bridge to look at the arches reflecting in the dark water, each with its reflection forming a perfect circle. A barge came through, loaded with wadded crates, and Vasily, held up by his father so he could see over the stone railing, spat down on one of the crates. "Shame on you," Ladislas Gaia said without heat. He was happy. He did not care if he had blubbered like a baby in front of Otto Egorin, the great impresario. He did not care if he was tired, and this was one of his wife's bad days, and he was already late. He did not care about anything at all, except the child's small firm hand in his, and the way the wind out here on the bridge between city and city carried away all sound and left one bathed in warm, silent sunlight, and the fact that Otto Egorin knew what he was, a musician. So far, in this one recognition by one man, he was strong, and he was free. It went no further than that, his strength and freedom, but it was enough. The trumpet tune of his Sanctus sang in his head.
"Papa, why did the big lady have things in her ears and ask if I liked chocolate? Do people not like chocolate?"
"They were jewels, Vasily. I don't know." The trumpet sang on. If only he and the little fellow could stay here a while, in the sunlight and silence, between city and city, between moment and moment. They went on, into the old city, past the wharves, past the abandoned houses built of stone, up the hill, into the courtyard of their tenement. Vasily broke loose, disappeared into a crowd of children, brawling, screaming, swarming in the court. Ladislas Gaia called after him, gave it up, climbed the dark stairs, and went down a dark hall on the third floor, let himself in the dark kitchen, the first room of their three-room flat. His wife was peeling potatoes at the kitchen table. She wore a dirty white wrapper, dirty pink chenille mules on her bare feet.
"It's 6 o'clock, Ladis," she said without looking round at him.
"I was in the new city."
"Why'd you drag the child so far? Where is he? Where are Tonya and Jivana? I called and called them. I'm sure they're not in the court. Why do you go so far with the child?"
"I went to—"
"My back aches worse than ever. It's the heat. Why is summer so hot here?"
"Let me do that."
"No, I'll finish. I wish you'd clean those gas vents in the oven, Ladis. I must have asked you 50 times. Now I can't get it lighted at all. It's filthy dirty, and I can't go scraping at it with my back like it is."
"All right. Let me change my shirt."
"Listen here, Ladis. Ladis, is Vasily down there in the court in his good clothes? Go down and get him right away. How do you think we can afford to get his good clothes cleaned every time he puts them on? Ladis, go down and get him. Can you never think of these things? He's probably filthy dirty already, playing with those big roughnecks around the well."
"I'm going. Give me time, will you?"
In September, the east wind of autumn rose, blowing past the empty stone houses and down the bright, troubled river, blowing scant litter about the city streets, blowing fine dust into people's eyes and throats as they went home from work. Ladislas Gaia passed a street orator, a little girl crying loudly as she ran down the steep street, a newspaper kiosk where the headlines said, "Mr. Neville Chamberlain in Munich," a big stalled automobile around which a crowd had gathered, a group of young fellows watching a fist fight, a couple of women talking earnestly to each other across the street, one standing on the curb and the other hanging half out of the tenement window, wearing a blue and scarlet satin wrapper. Note: British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain, 1869 to 1940, French Premier Édouard Daladier, Italian dictator Benito Mussolini, and Adolf Hitler met in Munich, September 29 to 30, 1938, and agreed that Czechoslovakia would cede its Sudetenland region to Germany. Chamberlain then returned to England and declared that the agreement would bring peace in our time. When Germany occupied the remainder of Czechoslovakia on March 15, 1939, Chamberlain abandoned his appeasement policy and declared that Britain would defend Poland against aggression. End note. He saw and heard it all, and saw and heard nothing. He was very tired. He got home. His young daughters were playing in the court in the well of shadow four stories deep. He saw them in the swarm of girls, shrilling around an areaway, but did not stop. He went up the dark stairs, down the hall, into the kitchen. His wife had been stronger lately, as the weather began to cool, but now she was in a vile temper and ready to weep. Little Vasily had been caught with older boys torturing a cat, pouring kerosene over it. They planned to set it afire.
"He's no good. He's a little beast. How could a child want to do a horrible thing like that?"
Vasily was locked in the middle room, screaming with rage. Ladislaskaya sat down at the kitchen table and put his head in his hands. He felt sick. His wife went on about the child, the other children in the court.
"That Mrs. Rasse, sticking her head in here without even knocking, and saying, 'Did I know what my little Vasily was up to?' As if her brats were something to be proud of, with their dirty faces and pink eyes like a lot of rabbits. Are you going to do anything about it, Ladis? Are you just going to sit there? Do you think I can handle him? Is that the kind of son you want?"
"What can I do about it? Are we going to have anything to eat tonight? I've got a piano lesson at 8, you know. For God's sake, let me sit down a minute. Let me have some peace."
"Peace? You want peace? What do you care if the child turns into a brute like all the others here? All right, what do I care either if that's what you want?"
She slapped about the kitchen in her pink mules, getting supper.
"Little children are cruel," he said. "They don't know what it means. They find out."
She shrugged. Vasily was sobbing now behind the door. He knew his father was home. Presently Ladislaskaya went into that room, sat with the child in the half-dark. In the third room, where the grandmother lay in bed, dance music blared from the radio. Ladislas had bought it second-hand for her. It was her sole amusement, and she never talked now of anything but what she heard on the radio. Vasily clung to his father, not crying anymore, worn out.
"You mustn't do anything like that with the other boys, Vasily,"
the father murmured at last.
"The poor beast is weaker than you. It can't help itself."
The child was silent. All cruelty, all misery, all darkness, present and to come, hung around them in the dark room. Trombones blared a waltz in the next room. He clung to his father, silent. In the thick blaring of the trombones, thick as sweet cough syrup, Gaia heard for a moment the deep, clear thunder of his Sanctus, like thunder between the stars, over the edge of the universe. One moment of it, as if the roof of the building had been taken off, and he looked up into the complete, enduring darkness. One moment only. The announcer talked, a smooth, excited gabble. When Gaia went back to the kitchen, he said to his wife, over the shrill voices of the two girls, "The English Prime Minister is in Munich with Hitler." She did not answer, only set the food down in front of him, soup and potatoes. She was still overwrought and angry.
"Eat and don't talk, you shameless!"
she snapped at Vasily, who had forgotten it all and was squabbling with his sisters. As Gaia walked down the hill, across the bridge over the Ross, in late dusk, a tune he had written was in his head. It was the last of seven poems he had set, all in a burst, in August. He kept wondering if that was enough to copy out and send to Oto Egorin in Krasnoy. But the last verse of the poem bothered him now, the one that meant, "It is thou in thy mercy that breakest down over our heads all we build, that we may see the sky, and so I do not complain." Note: the poem Gaia is struggling to set to music is by Josef von Eichendorff, 1788-1857, and begins, "Es wandelt, was wir schauen. Tag sinkt ins Abendrot, die Lust hat eigenes Grauen. Und alles hat den Tod." James Bittner translates the first verse thus: "Things change, whatever we look at. Day sinks into sunset glow. Desire has its own horror, and everything dies." The poem has been set to music by both Alban Berk, 1885-1935, and Dame Ethel Smythe, 1858-1944. End note. He had muffed that last line. It should go thus. Gaia sang it to himself, sang the whole verse over, heard the accompaniment. There it was. That was it. Pray God his pupil would be late so that he could work it out on the piano at the Schola before the lesson. But it was he who was late. When the lesson was over, his head was full of Clementi exercises, and though the melody was set now, he could not get the accompaniment clear. As he had heard it on the bridge, it had been purer, more certain. He tried the verse, the whole song, over and over, but the janitor was through cleaning and wanted to close the building. He started home. The wind was strong and cold now, the sky empty, the river black as oil under the arches of the bridge. He stopped there on the bridge a while, but could not hear the music he had heard. Back at home, he sat down at the kitchen table with the manuscript of the song, but with the weaker version before his eyes and no piano at hand, he lost even the mood of the accompaniment he wanted. It was all out of reach. He knew he was too tired to work, but nonetheless tried, doggedly, angrily, to hear and to write down. He sat half an hour motionless, never moving his hand. At the other end of the table, his wife was mending Tonya's dress, listening to some program of talk on the grandmother's radio. He put his hands over his ears. She said something about music, but he did not listen. The total impossibility of writing was a choking weight in him, like a big chunk of rock in his chest. Nothing would ever change, he thought, and in the next moment he felt a relaxation within him, lightness, openness, and certainty, utter certainty. He thought it was his own song then, raising his head, understood that he was actually hearing this tune. He did not have to write it. It had been written long ago. No one need suffer for it any more. Lehmann was singing it. Du holde Kunst, ich danke dir. Note: Charlotte Lotte Lehmann, 1888-1976, one of the great sopranos of her time, left Germany in 1938 because her stepchildren were half-Jewish. End note. He sat still a long time. Music will not save us, Oto Egorin had said. Not you or me or her, the big golden-voiced woman who had no children and wanted none. Not Lehmann, who sang the song. Not Schubert, who had written it and was 100 years dead. What good is music? None, Gaia thought. And that is the point. To the world and its states and armies and factories and leaders, music says, you are irrelevant. And arrogant and gentle as a god, to the suffering man it says only, listen. For being saved is not the point. Music saves nothing. Merciful, uncaring, it denies and breaks down all the shelters, the houses men build for themselves, that they may see the sky. Gaia put away the scribbled, ruled sheets of paper, the little volume of poetry, the pen and ink. He stretched and yawned. Good night, he said in his soft voice, and went off to bed. 1938.